Robin Daly with this week's Yes to Life show, the show in which I talk to experts from the field of integrative medicine about the questions that interest me and that are important to those with cancer. This week, I'm talking to Dr. Vijayendramurti about evidence-based medicine, or EBM. Now, you might be thinking that this is just a specialised subject only of interest to scientists and doctors, but in fact, I'd say we all need to gain an understanding of the basis for modern medicine if we're to be able to make judgments about treatment options being offered to us. We also need to know the criteria and driving forces behind the inclusion of some approaches and the exclusion of others if we're to have any perspective on the validity of this mechanism. Dr. Murthy is trained in both Western medicine and in Ayurveda and has a particular interest in the nature of research and the usefulness, or otherwise, of the results in helping restore health. So, hi Vijay, nice to see you again and thanks very much for coming on the show.
Hello Robin.
So, just a few decades ago, the notion of EBM was born out of a determination to move on from medicine based almost entirely in tradition and belief, and to build a solid foundation of science from which to work. If we fast forward to today, and we have a massive industry dedicated to medical research. Evidence has to now be one of the single most frequently used words in the news reporting in practically any sphere, but overwhelmingly so in medicine. So on the face of it, it's a great thing, but in reality it's less clear-cut, and there are some who would say that, much like many of the treatment options for late-stage cancer, the harm outweighs the benefits. So does EBM, evidence-based medicine, represent the massive leap forward for medicine that was envisaged?
That's a very pertinent question, Robin. For me, as a practitioner and also as a researcher, what I've realized is when I embarked on the journey of becoming a researcher, I was trained to really focus on design or methodology. And today, when I reflect on my training and my practice, I realize that evidence-based medicine is really focused on the narrow concept of research design as opposed to the broader concept of evidence itself. So the hierarchy of evidence that we generally today consider as the best in evidence-based medicine goes to the top of the pyramid, which is systematic reviews, which is basically looking at all randomized controlled trials and synthesizing the data to see if there is an effect or benefit. However, what happens with that is that, again, we are looking at evidence based on the study design and the tightness of the study design used, and not on the evidence itself. So whilst evidence-based medicine, as we talk about it today, can give us information whether a treatment works in a controlled situation, there is no evidence that actually it works in the real world. So there's paucity of evidence that evidence-based medicine works. And this is not a blanket statement I'm making, but it's a very important aspect for anybody who thinks rationally and wants evidence that's scientific to be asking themselves of.
Okay, so you're saying that because the environment in which these are carried out is totally unnatural, that the results actually don't bear that much relation to the real world.
Yes, it becomes hugely statistical, and the decisions obviously are made on the statistical output. However, if you are a patient, or if I act as a practitioner, I'm really dealing with an individual. I'm not just dealing with a condition. I need to be sensitive to the individual who has been diagnosed with this condition. Therefore, I cannot quite simply superimpose the artificial conditions under which the experiment was done to my patient.
No. Okay, so the effect of this is what? So basically, the evidence-based medicine is
it's logically a method of treating populations, that's what it seems like, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything about an individual that you're trying to treat.
Yes, yeah, and this goes back to the model of healthcare that we have chosen to practice. Definitely after, you know, industrialization and post-war times, yes, there was a need to focus on reducing morbidity and mortality at the level of population. But today, we have more and more people who are becoming aware of exercising their individual right to choosing the kind of healthcare that they believe in terms of the values, but yet is something which is scientific. And when you consider the shift in our focus as to what we consider is good health from population to personalized and individual healthcare, obviously evidence-based medicine has some value. It is not complete and it is not 100% relevant when it comes to treating an individual.
Yeah, well, I've long been aware that there's been sort of two government policies running in parallel, one of them to build up evidence-based medicine and the other one to build up patient choice. And it seems like they're completely mutually exclusive eventually, because evidence-based medicine seeks to tell people what they have to have, you know, because this is right. And of course, it's not a lot to do with patient choice.
That's right. That's because for a long time, we have believed that an improvement in health outcome is a direct result of clinical care.
Yes.
In fact, there is a lot of debate about how we define health, how we define well-being. And if we take the narrow biomedical model of defining health or illness, then evidence-based medicine makes total sense. However, if we shift from that to the participation of the individual, who is the patient, and if we are considering the various determinants of health, not just the biological aspects as in gender, sex, age, and hereditary factors, but lifestyle choices, personal values, the community where they live, the influence of society, then the socioeconomic influences on one's health, then we would have to broaden our focus from clinical care as the determinant of health towards public health. Unfortunately, to date, we still seem to have a very dominant clinical care focus in measuring health, and we haven't quite very well integrated public health and engaging communities and individuals in producing health outcomes. And that's exactly what you are saying, is that on one hand, evidence-based medicine says this is what has to be done. That comes from a very mechanistic viewpoint about the body. It's like body is a machine. When something goes wrong, you can fix it mechanically. But unfortunately, health and well-being is not just a mechanical issue. And therefore, we would have to make room for how to produce evidence, which is not just based on the hierarchy of evidence with golden standard, double-blinded, randomized clinical trials, but we would have to incorporate more effectiveness studies, which really looks at whether something works in the real world. And it is quite possible to adapt effectiveness studies or pragmatic studies. And when you, it is quite interesting that there's been a lot of debate now as to really do we need hierarchy of evidence or do we need typology of evidence. When you look at typology of evidence, this is possibly the most appropriate evidence to solve this particular situation, as opposed to thinking that for every problem, the solution is evidence-based medicine or what we learn from systematic reviews.
Mm, that's interesting. So it's like that overall thinking is kind of one of the great weaknesses of the system itself, that it doesn't have different ways or appropriate ways of looking at different scenarios. So, for example, I mean, it seems to me that evidence-based medicine as it stands for a surgical procedure pretty good, isn't it? Isn't that like brilliant?
Yes, yeah? Because that's a mechanical issue.
Yeah, so it obviously is very appropriate at times, but that, as you say, that's been applied across the board. When it comes into to treating somebody who with multiple chronic diseases, for example,
yep,
that falls down completely, it seems to me.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Hmm. Okay, so can we talk a little bit about practitioners and the effect on practitioners of the current model of evidence-based medicine and their clinical autonomy?
That again is a very interesting question, because in many ways, even though we believe that those who are practicing evidence-based medicine do use current evidence, it's almost practically impossible to do that, because evidence is all the time evolving. And at least about 1,000 or more research papers are published in medical journals every day, if you look at the number of journals which are there in the world. Mm. And how can a doctor, a GP or a specialist be able to decipher information from such a fast-growing field of evidence? So what we consider as evidence-based many times is slightly outdated, mm-hmm, because we are basing our decisions on evidence which was produced slightly before now. So that's one of the limitations. Secondly, if you talk to experienced practitioners, they'll always say that there is a degree of art that is necessary for a good doctor to traverse the paths between evidence-based medicine and what the person sees in clinical practice. For instance, many a times you could see a patient who presents with you or presents to you with a condition or a set of conditions, which is what most of the times that happens, is nobody comes to a practitioner, or very rarely a person comes to a practitioner with just one condition. They come with a plethora of symptoms and conditions, and there may not be any evidence either in basic research or even applied research, and that might be the very first instance when a practitioner is witnessing it. How do you then apply evidence-based medicine there? So there always is a need for the practitioner to take decisions based on their clinical experience. So we cannot undermine the importance of clinical experience of the practitioner when we are talking about evidence-based medicine. This isn't the real world.
But at Yes to Life, we're talking to a lot of people with cancer, and we're very aware of a vast number of people who basically tell us, rather in a joking manner, how about they've been given their personalised care plan, and they think it's about as personalised, you know, it's a computer printout. There's nothing personalised about what's been offered to them as a treatment for their condition. You know, they feel it's 100% prescribed by the system. It doesn't seem that in a lot of instances there is much, you know, clinical input there. Would you agree with that?
That's an unfortunate situation. And that's largely because we kind of always focus on cutting down costs and saving time, and there's a huge demand for health service, but there is not enough resources. And that's also because we do not engage health workers or communities or even patients themselves to actively take a decision. So it's almost like in any chronic condition, particularly cancer, it's very important that there must be an opportunity for a collaborative decision. But often the person who is diagnosed with cancer is in extreme fear, mm-hmm, and therefore she or he submits themselves to the authority and again trusts that their practitioner is going to give them the best options, but most of the times it doesn't happen in the real world. And although we use the marketing terms like personalized care, your choice, you know, we care about you, we take care of your psychological health, spiritual health or spiritual values and your lifestyle, by the time it is really translated into action, you will see that not much of it really happens. And the patient is left in the dark to explore their own choices. So there is not a platform where they can openly ask questions, openly discuss these. So there is always a divide between experts and the patient. And this divide in era where we have so much access to information, I find that quite intriguing, really, because there's a lot of information, but there is not enough opportunity to interpret the interpretation in a way that makes sense to the patient. And many times I also must say that practitioners often pay little attention to actually appraising research. Because when you really look at the number of papers that come out, most practitioners might just end up reading the abstract and then go by the conclusion, rather than being able to really utilize the appraisal skills for research to critically analyze if what is presented in a research makes sense or not. Because we do know that in research there is a trend to only report positive outcomes.
Right.
And so you're right, you know, both practitioners who are committed to actually engaging in a more holistic approach to taking decisions, or patients who are interested in understanding what's the best choice, we don't seem to have enough opportunity to discuss it appropriately.
Well, I try to imagine what it must be like from the point of view of a practitioner, of a doctor, that I would feel that evidence-based medicine, though, is an imposition on their political autonomy. You know, in the past, practitioners, some would say, have been far too free to go down whatever route they liked, and that these guidelines are helpful in making sure people don't go off the rails. But at this point, I feel like the scope for people to actually make a decision outside the box in response to a particular patient who has particular needs is limited, and, you know, fear of litigation and everything makes people very willing to be compliant, I would say, to what it says on the computer, and that must be extremely frustrating for a doctor who may feel he's able to help a patient by thinking outside of the box.
You're right, because even for practitioners to be able to make an informed decision that's based on their own individual views often becomes limited when there are certain protocols which kind of determine what is right and what is not right.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, in some ways I feel that's also because healthcare and medicine has become an industry. For me, it is interesting to watch that, because to become an Ayurvedic doctor, I was trained in India. And there, although it was a university training, there still was that apprenticeship model, where you were very sensitive to the values, you were very sensitive to health service as being a noble profession. And I have seen in the last two decades how actually my perception of what healthcare has changed so much that now it is an industry. And it is such a big industry that you know, I just might be a little church mouse trying to kind of fight something which is so big as an industry. And I'm sure that's the position of several practitioners and also of patients. And you know, you constantly face these conflicts.
When you spoke at an event of ours earlier this year, I remember a striking thing you said, that when you were doing research for a master's degree of public health, which was a place we had an opportunity to talk about what research really is in terms of its implications for the public, your professor told you one thing, that though you may have been a practitioner for 20 years, the one thing you hadn't understood at that point is that healthcare never was for the welfare of the people, it was always for profit.
Yes.
Now that's a pretty strong statement along the lines of what you're saying about a business. What are your thoughts on that, since being that being brought to your attention?
To be honest, you know, even when you say this now, I have goosebumps.
Right.
Because until then, you know, I finished my medical education and training in 1994. And this was in 2009. So until then, I hadn't thought of healthcare or medicine as for profit. And interestingly, this professor, who was my supervisor, because until then I was interested in clinical trials, quantitative studies. But then, for this particular research project, I took the more sociological, anthropological approach, and I was doing ethnography. And my professor is an expert in medical anthropology and you know, in New Zealand from the University of Auckland. And I kind of was asking the same question, you know, why is that? You know, we have money in developed countries, but why is that every individual doesn't get the kind of healthcare that they need to get? You know, we consider that we are developed because there's a welfare system. Mm-hmm. And she said, Vijay, I think you are very ignorant. There's one thing that you haven't realized, is that medical profession was never for the welfare of human beings. It was always for profit, and it will always be kept that way. And I guess that's when I started to compare the Western medical model with that of traditional systems of healthcare, such as Ayurveda or Chinese medicine, and the history of it. And when you look at the history of traditional systems of healthcare, profit is the last thing that you can see. Because even the textbooks that have been written, say, hundreds of years ago, all the authors, they dedicated to the previous physicians and say that I'm only summarizing the experience of what everyone else has taught me. But that fascinates me, that actually perhaps if we do seriously think about the history of medicine, probably if it wasn't for profit, we would be in a different situation today. Mm. Or maybe it is time for us to actually think about healthcare in a way that it is not for profit. It is not to support an industry, but it is to support human beings. It is for a human cause, which is noble.
Right. So, you know, out of if you look at the forces at work in healthcare, well, obviously, business is there to make money, and that's fair enough. You know, you don't have to expect that the businesses are going to be basically looking out for the human race. They're not. But we do sort of hope that our governments are supposed to be looking out for the population. But largely up to now, that doesn't seem to be the case. They seem to be overly influenced by the businesses that are trying to make the profit, and hence not interested enough in our healthcare. So that's a crying shame, but it seems to me that the balance has changed in healthcare significantly in the last, say, 10 years because of the arrival of the internet as a method for the public to inform one another and to say when they like something and when they don't like something, so politicians at least have to jump a bit when they get it wrong. So this is a great thing from my point of view. This is actually sort of genuine democracy as opposed to the sort of pretend democracy that we used to have. And It's got a long way to go, but it's a start. And it seems to me, if we bring it to cancer here particularly, right? Now, in the world of cancer care, research has been taking us in the direction of more and more complex, more and more expensive solutions.
Yes.
That's the way it goes. And if you just left business to itself and said, well, you do what you like, we'll keep giving you the money, that's what they do. Why would they do anything else? So at the same time, cheap, viable solutions have always been pushed to one side and actually actively attacked because they're actually, that's the market competition, so you always attack the competition to keep it down. That's normal business practice. But nonetheless, the public now is beginning to have its own say here, and there's a number of notable cheap alternatives which are finding their way to the surface these days, which the public is very interested in, and it doesn't waste time in trying to get governments to do anything about it. It doesn't waste time in trying to get industry to do something about it. They just get on and do it themselves. They get together, they club together, okay, we'll have a website for this solution, we're all going to start telling each other about it, we're all going to tell each other where to get it from, da-da, and the whole thing takes off on a completely different platform to everything that's happened before. And I'm very excited about that kind of thing because it actually does represent a completely new direction, which actually has far more possibility of finding a cheap, workable solution than would ever come from industry.
Yeah, you are right, Robin, because if you look at, our focus on integrative medicine, which is becoming a fairly well-known term today, is integrative medicine, where you look at various different approaches, not just medical model, but also the alternative and complementary medicine models or health promotion models that can benefit the patient, which ultimately is patient-centered or person-centered as opposed to discipline-centered. But it's very interesting to note that integrative medicine has become a discipline, or actually that concept is becoming more and more known, not because researchers or medical specialists or doctors or practitioners are engaged in promoting it. It's driven by people. Because every integration that you possibly see will have a certain role to be played by the person who has initiated that integration. So a lot of integration is patient-driven. And as you mentioned, because once there is more discussion amongst people about their choices of healthcare, it cannot be ignored. It has to be embraced and taken seriously, and has to be given its value. And therefore, whilst there is also a lot of harm because of information that's not very credible or validated that goes on social media about healthcare, particularly cancer, which can be quite dangerous because you do see postings which says, by drinking this, you can kill cancer in 3 days or 7 days, which is very, very dangerous. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if you look at the end of the other spectrum of internet information, there is a possibility for people to actually find out more information, explore and discuss and take part collectively in taking a decision about how they would want to negotiate this journey through cancer.
Mm. Yeah, well, so of course the people who have the greatest investment in it actually being some good for people are the people with cancer themselves. So they actually want to stay alive, so they have a serious interest in finding things that are workable, really.
Yes. Yeah.
So we they're a resource that we need to take on board and work with.
Yeah. I mean, interestingly, you will also hear that there are several hundreds and thousands of examples where those who have been diagnosed with cancer have gone back with complete remission of cancer, and there's been no explanation for that.
Mm.
But it's interesting that I was reading a book where we thought, why can't we actually look at those cases and find out how did they heal themselves of cancer? And the answer that I got was that because they are so rare that it becomes ignored.
But that's not really true, is it? They're not that rare, in fact. In fact, they're becoming less and less so.
Yes.
Because more and more people are becoming proactive, doing things that are not recognized by Orthodox medicine as being any help.
Yes, yeah. I think what we really need to look at is, you know, the solution is not really fighting against a discipline.
No.
Or fighting against an industry, or fighting against the establishment. It is about becoming aware that actually you and I, as individuals, can take 100% responsibility in taking decisions on how we want healthcare to be.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that commitment and passion to dedicate ourselves in that process. Many times it is usually because they have seen the suffering of a family member,
mm-hmm.
or they themselves might have gone through a very difficult time navigating through their own health issues, that they then start to initiate these discussions or form communities, which is very good. But I believe that we don't need to always wait until something goes wrong,
no.
or until, you know, until somebody we love is in a very difficult situation, and that's when we become desperate and start to ask questions. I think as individuals, health is the most important aspect for happiness,
mm.
and therefore today, especially when we have very well conquered infectious diseases, we need to be focusing on conditions that are possibly having triggering factors or risk factors from our lifestyle, and therefore it is very important that we take interest in our individual choices for healthcare, not when we encounter a health issue, but when we are healthy.
Right. So that's a very different, I mean, you know, culturally it's a whole different way of thinking, isn't it? And I think it's beginning to happen. Of course, the government wants it to happen because it can't afford the "we'll fix
yes.
you" model anymore. It doesn't work anymore. And so there's lots of encouragement supposed to be coming through to actually for people to actively engage in health promotion.
Yeah.
But it's just started, really. I think as a concept, though, it seems to me that in a kind of age-dependent way, it is there. People who are of a certain age seem to be much more health aware, if you like. You know, people who may be in their 20s, they got past the smashing their bodies to bits stage, but they're now informed to a degree that we never were, when I never was when I was young, about what the ingredients of good health might look like.
Yeah.
And so they are beginning to make some good choices, many of them early on, which is great, obviously. Yeah, okay, so can we come back a little bit to the alternatives in terms of research, useful research that could actually contribute to population health, which, an alternative, you like, to the pyramid of evidence-based medicine that we have now. Can you describe a bit more the kind of research you think we should be doing?
There are several pragmatic approaches to research, and one of them is effectiveness studies. And effectiveness study really looks at the benefits or comparative benefits of different research which actually has value in real world. So you're looking at cost effectiveness studies, or you're looking at making meaningful conclusions from observational studies, which are not necessarily randomized clinical trials. But even if you are considering randomized control trials, there's now this emergence of a new method of RCTs, which is called whole systems RCT.
Okay.
So when you consider whole systems, the whole systems is not going to treat every individual as the same or as an average, but it's going to treat a person as an individual and is going to look at interventions that might be highly specific for that person. But the way they do the research is that they use very scientific methods to actually conduct the research, which are whole systems research. For instance, there was a research that was done in America, UCLA, on rheumatoid arthritis. And they did whole systems research by using Ayurvedic medicine, which largely gives treatments or medications that are based on one's individual constitution. And also they change the medications depending on the response of the person over a period of time. And you would imagine that this, perhaps 20 years ago, would never have had any consideration in randomized controlled trials.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's so individualized.
Right.
Because it's considering the whole person, and how can you randomize that? But they used a very good whole systems method to conduct this randomized controlled trial. And then they found that actually the intervention which was done with Ayurveda had similar effect to methotrexate, which is a standard drug that's used in rheumatoid arthritis, and had fewer side effects than methotrexate.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, what is exciting is if we are able to have researchers who are capable of doing whole systems research, we might be able to accommodate the very variables which we would have considered as confounding factors in standard RCTs. So I would say that effectiveness studies and whole systems research can offer a lot to give us more evidence as opposed to just narrowing us down to certain methodologies, which may not serve a person in a real life situation.
So that's very interesting. I hadn't really gathered that kind of whole systems approach before. And so, if you like, the trial there is including the whole of Ayurvedic medicine, if you like, within the trial.
Yeah.
So that's a sort of given that they're taking us, right? We get to use that as a tool of the trial, so to speak. So, yeah, that's very interesting. And so, of course, within that, there's an enormous amount of flexibility about what's going to be done when, as opposed to an RCT, which is to... The aim is to remove all of those things.
Yes.
And, of course, as we're well aware in the whole arena of complementary and alternative medicine, any trial that's done on kind of drugs kind of style on complementary and alternative medicine usually makes a nonsense of it, and it seems like it's useless. But obviously the public thinks otherwise because they're paying for it in spades in this country, even though we have free healthcare. People spend billions on complementary and alternative medicine because they find it helps them, particularly for chronic conditions.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting. So yes, something like that, if it could gain recognition as a tool for research, would obviously open the doors for much more sophisticated and subtle ways of approaching what is, after all, an incredibly subtle subject, is human health, than the single chemical approach.
Yeah, and you know, there are two purposes to any good research. One is whether the results can be generalized or whether the results are transferable.
Okay, yeah.
And to a large extent, if we are looking at mass medication, then of course the research has to, the results of the research has to be generalizable.
Yeah, right.
That's where you're really kind of ensuring that all bias is excluded.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about transferability, which I think is something that we should not ignore, in the sense, you know, it may not be generalizable to all populations, but this can be transferred to another, you know, subset of a population, to a population that may share similar values or similar lifestyles, then that we are able to actually help that particular population. So if a research has transferability, we must kind of respect that as a very valid research. I think, you know, we probably focus too much on generalizability.
Mm.
That a patient with cancer, no matter whether lives in India who is a vegetarian, or a meat eater who lives in Scotland, or a fish and rice eater who lives in Japan, all of them, they need the same treatment. And this probably is where we kind of end up with limited options.
Okay, and maybe just have a last word on the comparative effectiveness research, just want to understand that fully. So, an example of this, could it be that, say a drug comes out of a standard randomized controlled trial as being, this is great for diabetes, yeah? Comparative effectiveness research would actually research just, well, how much does it benefit people, that drug? Is that true?
That's right.
From actually giving it to them, you'd actually find out whether it actually worked to a reasonable degree outside of a trial situation.
Exactly, yeah. So it's really, you know, in some ways, looking at whether what we considered as having evidence base, does it really work in real life?
Mm.
And if it does work in real life, then that what ultimately is useful.
Mm.
So as you mentioned, that yes, yeah, we know that there's evidence, but when you give it to a patient, by considering all the factors with which they come to your clinic, for instance, you know, it's very unlikely that any patient would walk into your clinic with the same criteria that was used in an experimental situation.
Right.
So in comparative effectiveness studies, you take into consideration all other variables, and then you systematically estimate the effect of it. And the lessons that we learn by doing that is what ultimately becomes the conclusion of comparative effectiveness studies, which probably is a very clever and practical and valid way of using evidence.
Mm. So you might find out that drug actually was quite good for one particular group of people, but for the rest it wasn't any use at all.
Yes, yeah.
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 So that's a very valuable
yeah.
piece of information.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, I think we're going to have to leave it there. We're just about out of time. So it's been really interesting. Yes, very many thanks for coming on the show and giving us the benefit of your overview on such an important subject. I think this is really, I mean, it's driving our healthcare in many ways. It has done, and maybe we're interested in looking in that changing in some way. And you've certainly given us a few pointers as to how that might go, with the directions that we might be able to take research in order to make it actually much more relevant to us human beings and getting well.
Yeah, it's been lovely talking to you, Robin. Thank you so much for interviewing me. Thank you.
As I said in the introduction to the show, I think this is a crucial subject for us all to be concerned with, not least because of the enormous impact on public health that could result from a move away from a profit-driven system. As usual, links to material associated with today's show are posted on the Yes to Life website. Go to yestolife.org.uk, yestolife.org.uk, and click the link to radio in the left-hand sidebar. Your thoughts on the show are always welcome. Please send them to me at radio@yestolife.org.uk. There's a new edition of the Health Triangle magazine out now on the UK Health Radio website with some additional material from my guests from past Yes to Life shows in the Yes to Life section on page 8. Next week, I shall be talking to the nutritionist Kirsten Chick, who has a decade of experience in supporting people with cancer. So I hope you'll be able to join me again. Goodbye. Mm-hmm.